We are delighted today to welcome back an old friend and a wonderful artist who has, I guess, resided far, far away from Pennsylvania for a long time. Donna Coleman, pianist. Welcome back to Crossover, Donna.
Thanks for having me again, Jill. It's great to be here.
Yes. Donna is, of course, you spend most of your time in Australia. Is that right, in Melbourne?
Yes. Well, in 1995, I moved there to take up a position in the Victorian College of the Arts. So I've been living there. Well, that was meant to be a 3-year contract, and then it turned into 6, and then it became a permanent position. So
yes.
I love my students so much. I haven't been able to leave yet.
Well, I think you kind of build, you know, a life in a place, and it's
yes.
very, very difficult. It gets harder and harder, even though for musicians who are used to traveling around, it is this, you kind of call it home at some point.
Yes. It's home, but this is still home.
Yes, originally
and,
from Pennsylvania, right?
Yes, I was born in the Temple University Hospital, so I'm really home right now.
Well, we'd love to have you, and of course, we can't keep up with you either. I kind of hear from you periodically as you release a new album, which all of them are delightful.
Thank you.
That's one of the reasons that Donna is with us today on Crossover. She is also concertizing in the area. But Donna really has had some incredible, I mean, awards. I don't even know where to start. She was a Fulbright Scholar, of course, and you were a recipient of the Solo Recitalist Fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts, and 3 Rockefeller Foundation grants, and international recording competition winner for the National Guild of Piano Teachers. I mean, we can go on and on. Kennedy Center. They're not retirement homes, and they're not elementary schools. Donna is an outstanding recording artist and has done some fabulous recordings. This one is particularly fascinating, Donna. Tell us a little bit about Ignacio Cervantes. He's Spanish, or is he Cuban?
He's Cuban, and he was born in 1847 in Havana, and he died in Havana in 1905. But in between, he spent 4 years in Paris studying at the Paris Conservatoire, and he also spent several years in New York City and also some time in Mexico. He was in exile for a while because he got into trouble with the Cuban government because he was raising money to support the revolutionary cause.
Yes, yes.
So he was found out, and he went to New York in 1875, and he stayed there for a couple of years until things cooled off a bit. But he got banished again in 1895. So, yeah, he had an interesting life.
Well, if you see Donna, she has a kind of a glint in her eye, and I think she probably – that was what intrigued you about him, maybe.
Well, yeah, partly that, because I suppose I've got a bit of a rebel streak
in myself.
But really, it was his music that captivated me. I knew nothing about him when I discovered his music in a score in the Duke University Library when I was teaching there in the 1980s. And because I had already been involved in a lot of musicological studies about ragtime music, because mm-hmm. and that goes back to my interest in the music of Charles Ives, who wrote a lot of ragtime music into his art music.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So for me, Charles Ives was the original renegade who was doing all these unusual things musically, bringing musical styles together that seemed to be incongruous with each other. And so his use of ragtime in his art music, piano sonatas
yes.
and symphonies and chamber music and all of that was fascinating to me. And that led me into my looking back into the 19th century to figure out
where did this come from?
Yeah. Because I wanted to create a context for Ives' music. At that point in time, in the 70s, the 80s, mm-hmm. Ives' music was was sort of being rediscovered.
Yes, it was. It was.
As a result of, well, it was his centenary in 1874, and then in 1974, and then in 1976, the United States bicentennial. There was all this interest.
American music.
Yes. So there was a lot of new scholarship about Ives' music, but there was still this sense that Ives was somehow or other an iconoclast who sprang out of nowhere, a bit of a hayseed who somehow or other had enough familiarity with classical music and went to Yale and studied with Horatio Parker. But,
yes.
You know, that was where he got the real polishing, mm-hmm. As it were.
As a composer.
Yeah. But I decided that there must be more to that story. So that was then I got interested in ragtime and figuring out where that came from and then how that might have traveled forward into Ives's consciousness. And so the discovery of Cervantes's music was just this fantastic moment for me because, you know, here was this music with this habanera rhythm, mm-hmm. that was so close to the cakewalk rhythm of ragtime.
Well, of course, they say that the influence was, mm-hmm. there, of course.
Yeah, and so that was so interesting to me to start reading these beautiful pieces. The music is just immediately captivating. It's so luscious, and the harmonies are beautiful. The voice leading is absolute perfection, and that's where I draw the connection even back to Johann Sebastian Bach, because these are like Bach's settings of the Lutheran chorales. You hear the beautiful melodic line, but then this incredibly rich sense of perfect voice leading and economy of texture.
That construction,
is what, yeah. And mm-hmm. the precision in the structure, and that of course all relates to the basics musical style that he's working in for these pieces. He calls them danzas cubanas or Cuban dances.
Well, there must be a format for a Cuban dance,
yes.
I guess.
They actually come from the contra dance.
Mm-hmm.
And his immediate predecessor, Manuel Saumel, who's considered to be the father of Cuban classical or Cuban art music, wrote many pieces in the same structure called contra dances. And that actually goes further
way back.
Back to France, where the contra dance, and then further back than that, back to England, where it was the country dance.
Yes, it was, yeah. It was
so these were very, very kind of regular formal structure, 16 bars plus 16 bars. And each half was repeated, and the key structure might change from first half to second half, but it would be very closely related. And so Cervantes inherited from Saumel this 16 plus 16 structure, but he calls his danzas cubanas. And to tell you the truth, I can't find that there's a real reason for doing that other than he just wanted to distinguish his.
Well, the rhythm, and, isn't there a rhythmic?
Well, the Saumel pieces are also shot through with the habanera rhythm.
Now, I was fascinated by the title of your album. Now that you finished talking about Cervantes on that level, it says, "Don't Touch Me."
"Don't Touch Me" is one of the tracks. There are 37 dances in this particular volume. There is one more solo, a Cuban dance that I have not included on here because I had a lot of trouble tracking down source material. So much trouble that, in fact, it took me about 5 years to finish this disc. I mean, that was also partly because my thumb got broken and other things.
Oh, my heavens.
Other life tragedies occurred in that period of time. But I was also trying to get to Cuba. I wanted to go and find the manuscripts because I wanted to see exactly what the manuscripts looked like, and I wanted to track down every possible danza that I could get my hands on. But in any case, there are 37 on this disc, and Don't Touch Me is one of the tracks. But it's very interesting that this particular title comes up because a friend of mine in Australia recently was telling me that he's a Spanish history scholar, and he said, you know, I reckon that there's more to that title than meets the eye, because he mentioned the Noli Mi Tangere, which is the Latin translation of that, which is associated with the Catholic Church, the tradition, or that the story about at Christ's resurrection, his mother encountered him, and he said to her, "Don't touch me." So that makes this even more rich, and my friend is convinced that because of the Spanish, the Catholic, and all of that, probably that's maybe one angle on that. But then there's the other angle, which is so many. I mean, these pieces, as I say in the liner notes, they unfold like scenes in a steamy romance novel, because you get other titles like The Jealous Woman and I Love You Very Much and Lost Illusions. And so Don't Touch Me could also be associated with that as well.
Don't Touch Me, No Me Toques, a song that definitely has a sensual ingredient.
Exactly.
And for people who love shoes, you have got to get this album. Donna is wearing a pair of shoes that they belie. You've got to wear them to play this kind of music.
Oh, I do.
Oh, they are marvelous. What are they, about 4-inch heels maybe, or even higher?
Yes, I think
And they're sexy as anything. And it's marvelous. The touch. It's that touch that kind of says it all. I mean, it's the above and beyond, the historian here and the musicologist and the actual pianist. There is this whole element of what you're talking about in each.
Yes. Well, I wanted to create a packaging that then, in a way, represents what the music
there is a sensuality,
about
it. And and one can't quite put their finger on it. As you say, you know, there is a double entendre with the,
yes,
with the title. So this is really, I mean, one has to smile, but I think Donna is full of surprises. Tell us, the audience, a little bit about your background. I mean, did you start as a pianist, or were you a musicologist, or how did this all evolve?
I think I was about 3 years old when the Sunday school piano teacher, I think she got tired of me trying to climb up on the bench next to her and poking around at the piano.
My.
So she taught me how to play Jesus Loves Me. It was my very first. And I guess it's significant that it was a hymn tune. It was
right,
my very
right.
first, uh-huh, because that's Charles Ives, and it sort of connects into that,
right,
because
right.
His music is full of hymn tunes, and many of which are very familiar to me from my childhood. So I believe that we didn't get a piano at home until I was 5 or 6, because I grew up in Philadelphia. We lived at 33rd and Diamond. That was my first home in Philadelphia.
Not far away. Yeah.
And then we lived in Yerkes Street in West Oak Lane until I was 5 years old. And then we moved to Ambler, Pennsylvania. And that's where I went to public school there. And I started having piano lessons at that time with the church organist, Gladys Moore. And from there, when I was in high school, I started studying with Ruth Lutie Campbell, who was well known in Philadelphia, mm-hmm, as a pianist and as a teacher. She taught at Beaver College. She also taught from her home, and she was a pupil of the Casa de Sous family.
Oh, yes. Of course, they were here.
Yes, so she used to go to Fontainebleau to have lessons with them.
And
yeah, so that was a very beautiful experience working with her. And then I went to Indiana University of Pennsylvania, where I was very fortunate to encounter a pupil of Arturo Benedetti Michelangeli.
Oh, wonderful.
Emigrated to the United States in the late 50s after the war, and he got a job teaching there at this relatively small school. You know, we think of Indiana University.
Yeah,
everybody immediately thinks of the really big one. And that's, you know, where one would assume that I'd encounter a really incredible piano teacher. But Niccolo Sartori was teaching at Indiana University of Pennsylvania, and I studied with him there for 3 years. And I was so privileged because he taught me so much about the color of music and about hearing, how to really listen. I think I learned how to really listen to music, and he also taught me so much about musical structure.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that Ruth was also teaching me these things, but sometimes it's a matter of you kind of reach a point where somebody's saying it to you in a different way,
right?
And you just, it just sticks somehow.
Well, also it has a tremendous impact on how you learn and how you play.
Yes. And the other thing that Niccolo did for me that that I really treasure is he was the one that instilled in me this confidence that I could take on any piece of music, no matter how strange it looked. Because he would – I remember when he handed me in my freshman year, it was one of my early lessons with him. Even in the first semester, he handed me the Anton Webern piano variations. And I opened the page and I looked at that and I thought, what is this? This isn't music. It was so completely unlike anything I'd ever encountered. And because growing up, I didn't have a lot of opportunities to hear music. We didn't live in the city, and so I didn't go to a lot of concerts, and we didn't have the internet in those days, so it wasn't a simple matter of just being able to download stuff. And so it was really a matter of what we had at home, which was more – I actually grew up listening to my father's favorite music and my parents' favorite music. My father loved Tommy Dorsey and the big band stuff,
sure.
So I got a real taste for that beautiful jazz music. And
now you also play jazz, don't you?
I shouldn't. I would love to be able to say that I play jazz.
Or you were influenced by Bill Evans. I mean, one of the greats.
Yes, Bill Evans. I would say Bill Evans and Michelangeli, I think, were the two most influential pianists for me, just from listening. But I can't say that I play jazz, other than the ragtime music, which is an early form of jazz, and I play Jelly Roll Morton. I've learned some of his pieces, which are evolved rags. It's like he takes ragtime to the next generation. James P. Johnson, I play some of his stride pieces,
right.
And I've studied pieces by Fats Waller. I haven't incorporated them into the repertoire yet, but
yes, I was curious because you are making choices. Now, how many albums have you released so far?
This is the fifth CD that's just my own playing exclusively on a CD, but there are a few other discs out there that have me as part of the. There's a Master Musicians Collective CD that is my performance with the Radio Orchestra of Bratislava, first premiere recording of a piano concerto that was composed for me by my old friend and also a friend of Niccolo Sartori's, Daniel Perlongo. And that was recorded in 1993. So that's available, all of these CDs.
What label is that on?
That's the Master Musicians Collective. And that's actually on... That's actually on the internet. I discovered it on Amazon.com.
Mm-hmm.
And the other CD that I'm on, just one track, is called The View from the Keyboard. And that is a disc that was produced by I'm trying to remember what the name of that label is, but that's also on Amazon, and that's me playing another piece that was composed for me, a piece called Death Angel Metamorphosis by John Anthony Lennon, who was a... Yes, I know. It's great. He was a classmate of mine at the University of Michigan. So
really?
So that's how that came about.
What is the Dancing with the Piano disc? What's that? Is that a disc?
That's not a disc. It's my philosophy of piano teaching and piano playing. And it comes from from my long experience as a student and the various teachers with whom I was privileged to study, going all the way back to Gladys Moore, but principally working from the point of my studies with Ruth, because that was an interesting time in my life. The French school of piano playing, they refer to it as the quiet hand school, and that goes, you know, to the virginals, the school of piano playing that involves having a very, very still hand and not really using the thumb so much. And there's that story about being able to balance
a coin
on the back of your hand. And I have to say that I found that very challenging because certainly in all of these years since then, I've moved completely away from that approach to playing the piano. When I was studying with Georgi Sándor at the University of Michigan, Sándor was a pupil of Béla Bartók's.
What a fabulous pianist.
Yes, and Bartók was also a brilliant teacher, and I believe had an approach to playing the piano that I believe was probably very close to mine, because I just, when I look at his scores and I see the way that he fingers passages, and they are very natural if you're using the whole body in a coordinated way. You can do things that might seem counterintuitive if you're trying to hold your hand very still.
Yes.
But Sándor at least got me thinking more about what goes on higher up in the body. Mm-hmm. So he got me thinking beyond the forearm and to the upper arm. But it was Sofia Rosoff in New York City, who is a pupil of the wonderful Abby Whiteside, that really opened the door for me. She got me thinking about how to use the entire body and then I took away from the few lessons that I had with her just enough of an understanding that I needed to start concentrating on the bigger picture of how the whole body relates to the instrument. Mm-hmm. So then over all of my years of teaching and, you know, I use my students as guinea pigs.
Yes.
I've experimented on them and on myself mostly. And I've worked out this understanding of also from studying Isadora Duncan and watching dancers and being a bit of a dancer myself and realizing that you've got to coordinate all the muscles of the body. It's not just what happens at the fingers and in the hand. And I actually believe that it all starts in the pelvic floor.
The core, yeah.
And that it's all about how one is actually balanced on the chair, and that the feet balanced at the pedals, and the four points of contact, heels, ischial bones, and then everything else is moving in what I consider to be a coordinated relationship with the phrasing of the music.
So you are utilizing the entire body, which in a sense is like a dancer.
Yes.
I see.
And I translate then what I perceive to be the musical gesture as the composer would have conceived it, I believe, as a dance.
Is this a theory that you use with students, or have you written a book on this?
I am writing it. I've got hundreds of pages, which will have to be edited significantly, and it's just a matter of finding the time to sit down and really put my head around that, because it's a very big project. But I will make notes, especially when I'm practicing and I'm doing things and I'm discovering things, and and words will come into my mind. I'll think, the word coordination, which, I mean, that was long ago.
Well, yeah.
But I think I need to explain what I mean. And so then I just have my files at the moment just listed as terms that I am explaining according to my principles and my thinking about this. But I would just, without sounding like I'm bragging, I really have to say that
it works.
Immediate results. Mm-hmm. It's almost frightening sometimes to see how a student can come into who's never had a lesson with me, and they come in and I watch them play and I see what they're doing, and I'll just kind of start doing a little bit of mm-hmm. this and get them to release, especially getting them to release through the hips, because so many people tend to sit up very erect through the back and lock. And as soon as you're locked at the base of the spine, then everything is done. Mm-hmm. And you would probably know this as a harpist, yeah, because, you know, you got to be all over your instrument.
Right.
You're surrounding it.
But we can't wear 4-inch heels very well.
Your pedaling. Yeah.
We can wear a little. But the thing is, I feel that's all part of what you're talking about. You have taken on a persona and your mindset to interpret this music. And I think we laugh about it, but it's very much a part of what you're doing. And I think that's very telling for people who will see the album. They'll say, wow. I mean, and it gets the message across right away. Now, you said that when we spoke earlier, you said that this was your own, you've produced this album, this Don't Touch Me album.
Yes, I decided to take on the challenge of doing it all myself, because I found that working with other
companies,
labels can just take forever. Now, of course, it did take me 5 years, as I mentioned, but that was my own fault. It was just other things going on. Curve involved in all of that. And I've called my label and my company, I call it Outbach, and because it's a project that I initiated about 10 years ago, because I was very determined when I first went to Australia, I wanted to develop relationships with indigenous communities and play music with them. And one of my first dreams was realized in 2003, when I was on ABC Classic FM on a nationwide broadcast with this fantastic didgeridoo artist named William Barton. And we played two of Johann Sebastian Bach's very beautiful chorale preludes as transcribed by Busoni and Myra Hess on stage and to the entire nation. And I believe that was streamed as well. And that was such a beautiful experience. It was profound. And
that, you can explain for the audience the instrument.
The didgeridoo is one of the traditional instruments of the indigenous people of Australia. It is a long, hollowed piece of wood, and it's they run about maybe 4 feet long, 4-5 feet long. They're generally played sitting down with the legs crossed, and the great artists do circular breathing, so they get a continuous sound. They will also intone the sounds of animals,
yes,
or other sounds into the didgeridoo, and they will also use what's called a clap stick to make rhythmic beatings on the side of the instrument, also to create a percussive effect. And it's just fantastic. It's just beautiful.
So what did you play with the artist?
We did the two Bach chorale preludes, and it was
amazing.
It was a truly religious experience for everyone, not the least of which was myself. I was practically crying. It was so meaningful, mm-hmm, because this was a world first. This had never been done.
And was that ever recorded?
It was we did it as a broadcast for ABC Classic FM It was on the air nationwide in a direct broadcast. So it was like, you know, we didn't record it beforehand. It was direct to air. So
and it was live.
It was live to air. But it was recorded.
So you actually, I mean, just speaking with you and kind of capsulizing what your interests are, you're a researcher, you're a musicologist, you are an anthropologist.
Yes.
And incidentally, you're a concert pianist and you love to wear high heels. So I think it's just a joy to speak with you. And we'll have to have you revisit us, Donna.
I'd love to come back.
And perhaps it'll be with your next album. But this Don't Touch Me is available now.
Yes.
And it can be gotten, is it on Amazon.com?
You can get it from Amazon, but you can also get it directly from the main distributor is cdbaby.com.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it can also be downloaded on CD Baby. So,
okay.
Yeah. So,
I know CD Baby got comments.
Yeah.
They've been,
and really, I have to put in a plug for them. They are a great company. They are so lovely to work with, and they've been fantastic. And so, I'm going to produce more CDs. The next one's going to be called The Lost Lady, which is, it's a rag by William Bolcom. That's going to be
whom we actually spoke with here on Crossover some years back. Yeah, well, he's really a wonderful composer and pianist as well.
Yes, and
so you're still going into the vein of American music and ragtime and more of the same. Come back, please keep us posted. Our arms are open to you, Donna Coleman.
And mine are open to you. Thank you so much, Jill.
Thank you.
It's always a pleasure.
Yes, it's a pleasure here too. Our guest today has been Donna Coleman. We've been speaking with her about her newest album, Don't Touch Me, music of Ignacio Cervantes. Donna's commitment to her craft, the joy she expresses in discovering the motivation of the composer, both aesthetically and emotionally, add to the depth of this recording. As she says in her voluminous and revealing liner notes, light up a Havana cigar, pour yourself a glass of Matusalem, and enjoy the memories and the dreams that Ignacio Cervantes inspires.